You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week for Dear Science, we are joined once again by expert Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
And what a chilly day it is. We were speaking about the cold recently.
Yeah.
In the newsroom.
Mm. Yeah, not liking the change, but you know, but it's the
we've
way
got, yeah, lots of science to warm us up, hopefully.
Yes, and starting with marshmallows.
Yeah, which is always good fun. I mean, the marshmallow experiment, lots of people will know about, but what is it, just for a refresher for people who have maybe forgotten?
Yeah, so the marshmallow experiment was all about examining delayed gratification in kids. So it was in 1970 in Stanford University in the US. And basically, they took a group of children between 3 and 6 years old, and the idea was they would offer the children a small reward, and that they could eat right then, or if they waited, they would get two small rewards later. So the way they would do it is they'd explain to the child in a room, you know, you can eat the marshmallow now or wait and you could get two marshmallows or a marshmallow and a pretzel stick. And the researcher would leave the room for 15 minutes, come back and see what did the kid do. And so what they did was they obviously recorded all this information, and then a few years on, they saw where these children had ended up and what they were doing in life. And so what they concluded was that the kids that tended to wait and get two rewards actually had better life outcomes as they parameterized by SAT scores, which is a measure of education in the US, other educational attainment, BMI and other things. And so that they concluded that children that could wait for their reward would maybe do better in life.
Yeah.
You could argue about the measures of what's better in life and such. But then there was obviously replication of these studies, and there were larger studies, and they actually found the strength of this effect between these children were waiting and how well they did in life wasn't nearly as strong as it was in this initial study. And what they found was actually that economic background also accounted for a lot of what was seen. And so a re-examination of the original experiment did actually put forward the idea that maybe it was actually a little bit more about the children's backgrounds as well and whether the children still trusted adults.
Yeah,
And so it's kind of formed it's a framework for studies that still go on now. And what this new study has done is actually look at how kids cooperate and whether there's like this social interaction that might change how children react to this scenario. So basically what they did is they did a few things a little bit differently. They did it all online. So the kids were just at home. They weren't in a new environment. It was their parent that was working with them. It wasn't some unknown researcher. The treat wasn't just a marshmallow. It was something that the parents had already indicated that their children might like. And so, again, what they would do was the child would be sitting there and then there was a screen where they had their partner. So it was another kid about the same age. And what it would be that they would get, you know, you can eat the treat now, or if you wait, you know, you could get two treats. And then the partner that was on the screen would say, I promise I won't eat this. Or they would say, I think I will eat this. So they were either promising to not or And so what they would do is then the parent would leave the room, and the kid that was on the screen was actually just a video. So they couldn't interact with the child at all. They kind of said, oh, there's technical difficulties. That's why they can't talk to you and stuff like this. And, you know, just examined how the kids reacted. And what they found was that if the partner child tended to go, I promise I won't eat this, then that kid was less likely to eat it. Whereas if they were like, oh, I think, you know, I might, then they were more likely to eat it. So it was more this social contract.
Picking up on, I guess, the other person's behaviour.
Yeah.
Replicating that sort of thing. Wow. Yeah. It's very interesting. I was imagining, like, I probably would have eaten the marshmallow as a kid, not just because I wanted the marshmallow, but because I was used to taking food quickly because I have a sister.
There are those other sort of things where we go,
like, you've got to eat it quick, otherwise
you dip out, right?
Right,
it's gone.
And what have we got next about snake antivenom? Strange way to get it.
So marshmallow science, I can get behind. Snake science, I'm a little bit less
scary.
I'm glad I live in New Zealand. So there's this guy, Tim Frieda, and he's was a truck mechanic in Wisconsin. Also used to describe himself and now is generally described as an autodidactic herpetologist and venom expert. And what that basically means, autodidactic, is you're self-taught. And herpetologist is someone who studies amphibians and snakes. And he's now actually the director of herpetology for this company called CentiVax. Now, why he's so fascinating is that for nearly 20 years, he self-administered, so he injected himself, with more than 700 doses of snake venom.
Wow.
Whoa.
So one dose of snake venom would be enough to...
Depends on the snake and how much.
Right.
So basically, escalating amounts of snake venom, escalating dangers of how much they're going to kill you kind of thing. He did this to start establishing an immunity in case he was ever accidentally bitten.
Right.
He has actually been bitten more than 200 times.
Wow.
Not by accident. Actually
deliberately.
Here, bite me.
And he hasn't died from any of them.
No, he's come close, though.
Oh, okay.
He's come. This is not advisable, people.
Right, okay.
He has nearly died several times. One of the instances, I can't remember what snake had bit him, but he was in a coma for 4 days.
Oh, okay. So we're talking very close to death.
Yeah. There was one story I was reading. Again, I can't remember the snake, but he was like, he'd been bitten, and he's like, right, I've got 15 minutes. Either I've built up enough immunity and I'm going to be fine, or I'm dead, because it was something that kills most people
in 15 minutes. Yeah.
So, an interesting guy. It would be really fascinating to talk to him one day, I think. Not that I'll ever probably get the chance, but yeah. So yeah, he's basically developed this immunity to snake venom. And so what a group of scientists have gone is like, cool, we'll work with you and we'll look at your blood and see what we can get out of it. Because the way that antivenom was traditionally being made for about 100 years is what you would do is you'd milk a snake, a venomous snake, and then you would give it to an animal, like a horse or a sheep or something, and you would gradually increase the dosage, and then you would take their blood and you'd purify out these antibodies that were antivenom.
Yeah, right.
There are some other techniques now, but this has been, by and large, what we've used for a long time. And what the problems that you get with this is that you can actually get allergic reactions. So in some countries, 50% of the time that they give antivenom, the person actually then has an allergic reaction.
Wow.
They have anaphylaxis as well.
50% seems like a very high amount. Yeah,
high, right? And then also these tend to be very species specific, and it turns out they can be region specific as well, which I found quite fascinating. So while we have these antivenoms, it's not ideal at the moment.
Yeah.
So they took some of this guy's blood and purified out some antibodies, and then they've basically done testing to see if it's how good it is and what it would go against in terms of snakes. So they looked at the World Health Organization categorizes snakes in terms of how deadly they are. So 1 in 2 are the most deadliest sort of thing. So they picked 19 of those from what are called the elaptid family. So these are the snakes that have the fangs that are always out.
Right.
That's really scary looking ones. I'm not a snake fan.
Yeah. Me neither.
And about half of the deadly snakes belong to this family. So this is your mumbas, your taipans, your crates and stuff like this, which we're starting to get a lot more of these deadly sneeze snakes start washing up on our beaches. You'll have noticed in the news lately. And so they isolated the antibodies out of this guy's blood, and then they've just tested it against the neurotoxins from these different snake species. And then once they've figured out which antibodies seem to work, then they were looking at his B cells, which are a type of immune cell. They were sequencing the DNA so that they could find the genes that coded for these antibodies, and then use a bacteriophage, which is a virus, to infect a cell, human cell line, to then become a mini factory to make it, kind of thing. And then they've tested on mice. So they haven't gone testing on people. And no, there was no point getting any snakes to bite him anymore because he's immune now.
Right.
And so what they've done is they basically put different combinations of these antibodies together with a drug that's also being developed for as a to treat snake bites because it's known toxin inhibitor, and started to see which combination gave like the best coverage against these 19. Mm. And so they actually found with using just two antibodies and this small molecule drug that they could get protection against most of this panel of these snake venoms.
Wow.
So the drug protected against like three species, one of the antibodies was like six, and then the rest by the other one. So it's quite amazing to have a drug cocktail that's against so many different species of snake. And you also get past, because now you're using human cell lines, you're going to get past a lot of those allergic reaction problems and stuff like this. And so their main aim is to develop, if they could get a single cocktail that was against all snakes, it'd be like great. Probably more realistic is they'd get one that's for these elapid snakes, so these and the fangs out, and then the other big family of vipers. And then you've got a lot less problems about what snake bite bit you in there.
Yeah, just take the cure-all snake.
And then the other thing that was really fascinating, as you can imagine, Australia is kind of up there with doing a lot of stuff in this space, given their snake population. So the next round of testing is actually going to be in dogs that end up at the vets in Australia. And because
of snake bites.
Exactly, right. And so it's challenging to treat them. So it's actually a really cool population to test out your drugs, right? Because often these dogs just die anyway.
Yeah, so. Right. Wow. So I guess some good, obviously not to this guy, but some good is coming out of his...
he's now like, so he's now part of this company, and they're looking at him. He might actually make a lot of money out of this eventually if it goes well. But what possesses you, right?
Like, to inject yourself with snake venom every day. I mean, that's insane.
And like, in all these different species, like he had to get all these snakes and then milk them and then do... Because, I think it started with doing bites, but that's not very controlled.
No.
And so
it had to get more scientific, obviously.
Yeah,
right.
And then getting them bite you was kind of became a bit more of a showpiece.
Mm. And this last bit about lithium ion batteries. What's going on here?
Right, so we're very dependent on lithium ion batteries, right?
Almost everywhere, right?
Exactly. Mm. All our rechargeable devices with the batteries, typically lithium ion batteries. This is because they've got a high energy density, they're energy efficient, they've got a longer life than many other rechargeable batteries. They've made such an impact in our life that in 2019, this was actually what the chemistry Nobel Prize was given for, the development of these.
Mm.
And so a battery is basically anode, cathode, electrolyte. And so... in the case of lithium-ion batteries, what happens is that you charge the battery and your lithium ions will move to the cathode and that becomes positively charged. And then when you discharge the battery, the lithium ions move back towards the anode, but they're moving through this electrolyte, this stuff in the middle. And typically what we have at the moment is this stuff is either a liquid or a gel. And they tend to be lithium salts in an organic solvent. So they're flammable. They're a fire and explosion hazard. So, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, there was a company that was fined by the council for a fire that happened last year or the year before, and it was about disposal of these lithium ion batteries stuff. You know, you get all these warnings about your charging and stuff. Mm. So obviously it'd be good to have something that's a little bit safer.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of development in solid state batteries to basically increase the safety of these batteries and also to increase the energy density. And what's happened in this study is they've actually developed a material that's quite an improvement. So for the electrolyte, this is where it becomes the solid. So they had a lithium antimony crystal that they were using. And what they've done is they've just added another type of metal or type of compound into it, scandium. And so what this scandium does is it basically pushes out some of the lithium ions, creates some holes. And so now into the crystal structure. So now you've got these holes, basically, that the lithium ions can move through.
Mm.
And so what they did when they did the measurements was they're like, wow, it's working 30% faster than what we previously used. So fast that they went to another lab and said, can you do some measurements for us and confirm what we've got? And so by creating these graps and this crystal structure and allowing these lithium ions to move faster, this is actually a really great step in terms of producing solid state batteries. lithium solid-state batteries that could be usable. It's basically, they're saying, you know, like it's basically a new blueprint for battery development in terms of the lithium solid-state battery space, because you could, like, this was a lithium antimony battery, but there's lithium sulfur batteries and stuff where the same sort of thing could work. And so we don't actually have lithium solid-state batteries widely available on the market yet. Some reading I did was like there's supposed to be some coming out this year, and then Toyota and BYD and stuff like in the next couple of years, so we will start seeing them soon, but there's always obviously going to be this drive for better and faster.
Yeah, and with that 30% faster, what does that mean in like actual use of the battery?
So it's going to be that it can recharge faster and stuff, and then because it's solid state electrolyte, like it's going to last longer overall, and it's going to have more recharge cycles, and so it's just, you know, a better use.
It seems better overall. All right, well, thanks for sharing these strange and interesting science stories with us. Hopefully nobody will go out poisoning themselves with snake venom. Though if they do, they should be sure to share their blood with the scientists. All right, well, thank you for coming in, Kushla. Thank you, Moshat. And thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.